Welcome to Alchemist X Innovators Inside, the podcast where we explore the world of corporate innovation and dive deep into the minds of thought leaders, high achievers, and risk takers. I'm your host, Ian Bergman, and together we'll uncover the challenges, triumphs, and secrets behind successful innovation journeys. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur, an industry veteran, or simply curious about the ever-evolving landscape of innovative ideas and what it takes to put them into practice, this is the podcast for you. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's embark on this exciting journey together.
Amali, it's good to see you.
Hello, Ian. So good to see you. How are you doing?
Oh my gosh, I'm doing well. Thank you for coming on the podcast tonight.
I'm super excited, and a sincere thanks for inviting me to come and sort of just chat rubbish across the pond, and just hopefully I think we'll have a really nice conversation. So really lovely to be here.
Yeah, it's really great. And for the audience, I consider Amali a friend. Amali's a former colleague, but also just an incredible person. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I feel like every time I talk to you, I learn something, and every once in a while I get inspired, you know, not to set expectations.
And we always have great chats here. I love catching up. And yeah, we definitely need to be doing this more often.
Oh, amazing. Well, by way of introduction, I would just like to introduce everybody to Amali D'Alis, currently a portfolio non-executive director and startup business consultant. And Amali's got just an incredible kind of career history. She's been a serial entrepreneur, most recently was CEO at climate and data accelerator Subac. And prior to that, she was a managing director at Microsoft for Startups UK and the CEO of Code First Girls. So, Amali, that's a little bit about what people can sort of read on LinkedIn, but yes. Why don't I ask you to kind of tell your own story? Like, how did you get into the world of innovation and how did that lead to where you're focusing now? Start wherever you like.
Oh, my goodness. It has been a roundabout journey, Ian. And I know we've kind of chatted a little bit about this before, but I was just a curious kid who liked to build things. I think that's probably where it all started. And I think the biggest thing for me was also someone who just liked to go and try new things, to make things, to build things, to ask people questions, to figure out how the world works. And, you know, and this idea of fairness, I think, in the world was really important to me. So I started my career, I did engineering as my studies, didn't want to be an engineer, so did a degree in shoe design. Went and did a shoe design graduate studies, then decided I didn't want to be a designer, but actually I really like the thinking behind design. So why is it that we have to design things in a certain way, sure. Which led me into research. So thinking about, I was a quant researcher for a big research company. And that was, I think, really where the kind of the innovation journey started. So really thinking about how do we understand the world around us? How do we help the brands, my clients that I was working with to understand the landscape they operated in and think about how we create products and services which work for that and how do people fit into that. And that, I guess, led me into sort of my sort of forays into the quote unquote sort of tech industry, even though I'd always been a bit of a geek and I, you know, love computers and, you know, studied engineering. I hadn't done, you know, software engineering until I went to uni and did my first dabbling coding, which was learning Fortran, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone as a first language. It is brutal and unforgiving. But I really like the idea of, you know, thinking about how technology plays a role. And I was lucky enough in that role when I was a researcher to end up being what they called a mobile champ. So digital champ, thinking about how digital works in products and services. And that then sort of led me on. I swapped from being agency side into client side. So working from basically, you know, providing services to a client to actually being the client myself. And then following a secondment, which I did to the World Economic Forum in Geneva, where I ate a lot of cheese, ate a lot of chocolate, came back home.
Did some real work too.
Yeah, I did actually do some work as well, but I did eat a lot of cheese and a lot of chocolate. But came back home, like a lot of people, I guess, at that kind of stage in career. And I was just itchy. I was just kind of, you know, banging my head against the top of, you know, what was a very big company when I was working at PwC at the time and just going, I just want more from this. I want something which is more creative and more innovative and, you know, something that moves faster and something that solves problems. And realized that, you know, that just wasn't the type of job that I was going to be able to do in a big company like that. So took the plunge, took my first sort of senior leadership role, joined Code First Girls as their first chief exec and was brought in to build the company. And I guess everything else sort of stemmed from there. You know, spent 4 or 5 years building that out. They have gone on from strength to strength, and now I think have taught over 40,000 young women how to code for free. They run training programs with big companies. But all of that was really, I guess, almost a reflection of my own journey, which was, I was a bit of a geek. I really enjoyed building things. I was curious. I thought that we needed to make a difference in the world. And here was a great engine for me to be able to, I guess, exercise that as well and hopefully help some others kind of go on that journey as well.
Well, that's awesome. And I know that's led you to doing some really interesting work more recently in your career. We're going to get to that, but I want to talk about a couple things here. Like, there's a certain aspect of your story that indicates some restlessness, right? So maybe...
I have ADHD. So actually, I had a late life diagnosis around this. And, you know, for anyone who is neurodiverse, like I really struggled with exams. I was horrible with exams. My brain just doesn't work that way. But give me a research project, I just go down holes. I'm a really good digger into ideas. And I think you might hear sort of people talking about divergent creativity. And I think that's something which, you know, when you think about sort of diversity of thinking, I really enjoy just taking problems and unpicking them. And, you know, that's the whole point as far as I'm sort of concerned, which is to solve these big problems and just figure out really creative ways to do that. And I think that's that restlessness sort of coming through there.
It's awesome to hear through sort of the lens of your own life and your own career. I think it's such an interesting takeaway for people that are feeling restless within large organizations, right? Like that is an indicator that something can be changed in your own life, et cetera. And change is required change is required to drive change. Boy, I was going circular there.
It is. And I do this absolutely from a position of privilege. You know, I live in a quote unquote sort of Western developed country. I had an education, I had a supportive family. I had opportunities to be able to take that restlessness and go run with it, you know, to take that somewhere and put it to good use. And I know that not everyone has those sort of, you know, abilities and those options in life. But I do think that if you are someone who is restless and you feel that you can make a difference, why would you not want to? You know, why would you want to do something which just makes you unhappy and, you know, leaves you unhappy at the world around you? You know, if you can kind of, you know, look to 20 years time and leave the world in a slightly better place. And I think it might have even been a Bill Gates quote or someone who sort of said, you know, we underestimate what we can do in 10 years and overestimate what we can do in a year. And I think that's completely right. You know, it's little steps. And I think especially when people sort of look at, you know, other people's careers and they see sort of, you know, people who are greatly accomplished, it doesn't happen overnight, right? It's accidents and mistakes and, you know, little things which kind of happen. And suddenly you find yourself 10 years on with this realization of, my goodness, it's been a busy 10 years. You know, we've managed to do a lot. So yeah, definitely take those steps.
It really has. And I love that quote. It's one of my favorites. I don't remember the exact quote, but what I love about it is that it scales up and down so nicely. Like you can underestimate a decade and overestimate a century. Wait, I had that backwards. You know, like, and it actually goes within a day. I've actually found that, you know, that scales right down to within the day.
Completely.
But you can look back and be like, oh, I've accomplished so much. Okay. So shoes have been around a while. You know, this was early work, but you were framing it up as working on innovation, evolution. Like, so here's where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
Some of us are so sort of like lost in the intersection of quote unquote innovation and tech or deep tech. I think sometimes we forget that you don't always need, you know, a digital expression of an item for there to be innovation. Talk to me about shoes.
Shoes for me, and the thing which I loved about shoes, and I think this kind of goes to the kind of the real practical sort of hands-on element, is that it's true form meets function. Right? It is something which just has to work, right? You can't have a shoe that, well, you could have a shoe you can't walk in, but they don't really work very well as shoes, right? So the idea of, you know, something which is required to do a job is really critical, but you've got to understand what job it's got to do, right? And this is kind of, I guess, that fundamental sort of thread of any creativity and any sort of innovation, which is, it's not just about solving a problem. It's about understanding how people are going to interact with this object. You know, why do they want this? Where is the need? How do you find an opportunity? What's missing from the competitor landscape? And even when I think about when I actually switched careers and I got that first job as a quant researcher. So I hadn't done economics at uni. I hadn't even done maths since A-level. And I basically got a little bit lucky with a job which I applied for, which was a research exec, and the recruiter who thought I looked interesting. And that was it. And I went into their office, and I didn't realize this at the time, but it was her first day. So she was completely new. And I literally turned up with my fashion school dissertation, right? Which was meant to be Amali being really creative and designing shoes. What I'd actually done was written like an 18,000 word market segmentation study, right? Which was really around saying, look, you know, this is the particular kind of positioning of this item. What are people trying to do? How do they need to interact? Where do we need to kind of think about the product positioning, the pricing structures, competition? And I remember her sort of looking at me and then looking at my report, looking at me again, looking at the dissertation. She calls in her colleague. They look at me, they look at the dissertation, and they sort of look at me and go, I think we can see why you want to do this, because it's just the way your brain works, right? You kind of take this question about how do we build something better in this space and then go and try and understand how do we kind of position that into some sort of creative, innovative form in whatever expression that is, whether that's a practical item, a concept, a design, technological sort of base, materials technology, you know, whatever that is. But I think, you know, this is something hopefully I think probably a lot of sort of people listening to this podcast as sort of founders and people working within startups can kind of sympathize, which is just, you just get that itch around, you know, there's got to be a way to do this better. And can I think of a way, can I understand what's going on enough to be able to create that and just make it work, make it resonate?
Well, I love that. And I think that's a recurring theme, I think, across so many of the stories that we hear and we tell on this podcast. And it actually extends nicely into the corporates as well and into the enterprises, because people feel that restlessness, that better way.
Yeah.
To your point, it's not always the most conducive environment to driving change, driving something better. But when it is, you get great scale.
Yeah.
We may come to that a little bit, I think, particularly in the context of Subak in a minute. I'm going to put a pin here because there's something else we're going to come back to as well. You talked about, you know, fairness as being sort of fundamentally important to you. Little teaser for you and for everyone else. I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
Because I think that's really interesting in the context of, well, innovation and change. But okay, so you touched on this briefly, but tell us more about Code First Girls, because that's an organization that has impacted a lot of young women.
Yeah, and you know, it's still to this day, you know, one of the things I'm most proud of as far as the work that I've done. And I think the part which particularly, I think, resonates is not just actually even the work that was done, but the cascade impact of that. So Code First Girls was actually started as a program within an organization called Entrepreneur First. So they're a pre-seed accelerator. They did a little pilot, which they called Code First Girls, as a way to recruit young women onto their accelerator programs. And what happened was that as they were growing, they themselves changed from being a community interest company of social enterprise to being a fund. Because of the way that CICs are set up in the UK, they had a little bit of money which was locked into the company, and they run this pilot. So they basically brought me in and said, look, we've run this pilot. We've got a little bit of money. Do you think, you know, is there legs in this? Can you make this work? And as I sort of started digging into it, and I think this was kind of, you know, I wasn't brought in as a DEI expert. I was brought in really as someone who could look at a problem and build solutions for that, you know, and this is what I'd been doing as a researcher, working with clients and stuff as well. And what we realized sort of looking at the UK landscape at the time, and sadly, I don't think that this has changed a huge amount, only about 13% of software graduates at the time were women. That accounted to, you know, 3,000 women a year or something like that, which was at the time. We were obviously seeing this huge boom as far as the tech industry, loads of money going into this, you know, and this is sort of, you know, mid-2000s. And the reality was that, you know, half the population weren't really involved in building these objects. You know, we now carry supercomputers around in our pockets, and yet these items are being created by this tiny slice of our population. So this was really around saying, look, we need to make sure that technology is fit for purpose. We also need to make sure that opportunities are open to women. And when we're talking about these opportunities, these are interesting, exciting, well-paid jobs within an industry which is growing. And we just weren't supporting young women to do this. And for a million different reasons. You know, you can talk about childhood issues and all of these types of things, you know, exposure to tech as sort of kids. But the reality was that if you were someone who hadn't done this when you were a child, it was really hard to get into it.
Sure.
And so Code First Girls was really positioned as a route back in. So this was focused on women who were in their late teens, early 20s. If you were someone who was bright and curious and just wanting to get into a tech industry but didn't have a tech background, here was your way back in. This was the way for you to re-enter if you thought that you'd already missed the boat. And it was extraordinary how within the space of 3 years, we were teaching more young women how to code than were doing software degrees in the UK, in the entirety of the UK.
That's incredible.
You know, such was the small numbers that we were doing. And thinking about that cascade impact, I think it really kind of hit home for me. I remember once I saw a tweet. There was a young woman who'd been granted a spot on one of the courses that we ran, hosted at Twitter. So they were one of our corporate partners. And she was being taught by a volunteer instructor who was a young woman who had done a Code First Girls course about 8 months before that. And she had been taught by another young woman who had done a Code First Girls course about 8 months before that. So in the space of about a year and a half, you had three generations of individuals who were teaching each other and helping each other to get into this amazing, exciting industry. So that point around sort of cascade impact, I think for me is just so important, and how even as a small organization, if you hit the right angle, if you really get your product market fit right, you know, to put it in that parlance, you can do something really incredible, which just runs away with itself. So yeah, that was, I guess, the CFG journey. And it's gone on from strength to strength even after I've left, which I'm incredibly happy to see.
Well, and that's amazing. And have you been able to follow, maybe through the eyes of some of the women who went through it, kind of the impact and how that has, well, you know, what the follow on, the knock on effects have been?
Absolutely. I mean, we had like actually one of my past students recently got in touch. She's been a software developer at a big software house for the last 5 years. Another ones who's gone on to do computer science degrees, other ones who are working as data scientists for big banks. We have people who are now working at, you know, companies ranging from Facebook to Google, and others who actually aren't. Like I remember one young woman who she became a lawyer. But she actually does a lot of work around tech. So I think this is the thing where, you know, not all of us need to be developers. And goodness knows, if the whole world were devs, that would probably be a slightly scary place. And I say this as someone very fond of all of my developer friends. But at the same time, you know, we live in a tech foundation world, right?
Yep.
And I think for you, for anyone who is heading into any industry, whether that is law, whether that's teaching, whether that's medicine, whether that's working for, I don't know, public services, whatever it is, you have to understand what technology does. You have to understand the role it plays. You have to understand the fundamentals, because otherwise you're just not part of the conversation, the decisions which are being made around how all of us are living our lives. So yeah, really, really important thing, whatever people are going on to do.
Well, I love that point. I think, you know, so often when we get into conversations around DEI, around equity of access to whether it's venture capital or tech, or whether it's just about, you know, representation in a particular industry, when you start to dig back in, I feel like so often what I see is who has the context,
yeah.
Who actually has been exposed to the ideas early, who knows what's possible, et cetera. So living in a tech-enabled world, understanding some things about tech, really helpful.
And I think thinking about, I mean, even looking at the VC world, you know, when we're talking about, you know, creating patterns of generational wealth, right? Be allowing people to achieve enough sort of money in their lives to be able to support themselves, their families, to be able to take advantage actually of those rising markets as far as the tech industry goes. You know, we're still talking about such a narrow field of access. I think what was it, recent study which was showing that 1.5% of venture money goes to women, for example.
Yep.
Can you imagine if you went to a bank and the bank said, we only give 1.5% of our bank loans to women? I mean, there would be uproar, yeah. And yet, you know, we accept this as being something which is, you know, just part and parcel of, you know, how people are making money and getting involved in technology these days. So yeah, we have to do better at this, I think.
So let's go to Subak. So this is a bit of a jump, but I'd love you to sort of talk a little bit about the work that you did at SUBAC, because, and here's where I'm going with this, you get a certain number of individuals, and it's not going to be everyone, and it shouldn't be everyone, but you get a certain number of individuals who decide, I am going to sit down, I am going to roll up my sleeves, I'm going to try and do something incredibly hard against a maybe intractable problem, right? And we see people doing this in energy and climate and software, you name it. To me, as a kind of naive outsider, SUBAC feels like an organization that was and is trying to enable some of those people. Can you tell us a bit about what you did at SUBAC and what that organization is doing?
Yeah. So again, with SUBAC, I was brought in really to build the company. So the first chief exec to really think about, look, how do we solve this big problem, which is that we have the biggest problem in existence. It is literally, you know, our planet is on fire. And it's funny because I know we've obviously had lots of, you know, horrible discussions recently around, you know, the war in various different countries. And looking back, I would hope we find a way through with those situations. You know, politics comes and goes. The challenge around climate, that may not go away, right? Yeah. This is something which impacts all of us. No one will be spared, right? And if we're talking about, you know, as technologists, as entrepreneurs, as people working in the startup industries, you know, we want to solve big problems. This is the biggest problem there is, right? And SUBAC really came about to say, look, we know that this is the case. We also know that it's a sort of a growing area, right, where there is a lot of public pushback still, right? People who will claim this does not exist, this is not a problem, we do not need to worry about this. And there is so much that needs to be done as far as problems to be solved that we need as many smart people working on this as possible. We just need people to go out and tackle it a million different ways. This is not a single solution. This is, you know, hundreds of solutions. And SUBAC's positioning to that was to say, look, we absolutely have, you know, an important role to play from the funded industry. So the equity funding, VCs, PE side of things. But looking at some of these problems that we'll need to solve as part of tackling climate change, some of those issues may not deliver profits or may not deliver profits in a classic way. Some of those challenges might need people to be doing things with government or public sector, which again is not something which VC funds readily, generally speaking, you know, it's not part of the kind of model. So this was to sort of say, look, we need people who are going to solve in these areas, right? Because we know that legislation, for example, is a really big way to solve these issues. But also, we know that in order to make compelling arguments, in order to solve problems more quickly, in order to be able to share findings so that others can also pick up, and so we're not just repeating things over and over again, we also need to tackle the data side. And, you know, looking against a landscape where traditionally what we do with data is, you know, we all our organizations, we collect data, terabytes of data every single day. We then sit on that data for a decade until it becomes obsolete. And if you're lucky, someone hears about it and goes, oh, that's really old. If you're unlucky, someone doesn't even realize it has existed. So SUBAC was really targeting that side of things to say, look, we need people solving problems. We need them sharing their data once they do. And then we need people to be able to tap into that data and to then build on that and build problem solving collectively quicker. Because frankly, if we do not do that, if we do not share information, if we don't share our learnings, then, you know, we're all just going to be sitting here treading water until, well, we're treading water because, you know, the oceans have risen and, you know, that's going to be a tragedy. So that's where SUBAC came from. And to do that, we ran an early stage accelerator program for not-for-profit organizations. And SUBAC ran a data catalog, which again was around mapping that data, making it visible. And even if you had a commercial need to sell the data, do whatever you need to do it, but let people know it's there. Because the only thing worse than having to pay for the data access is where you need to go and then repeat the exercise because you don't realize someone's already tackled it and you can, you know, save time, money, and resources.
Sure. And so do you see a connection between the work that you were doing with Code First Girls, or more broadly, sort of passion in helping both the underrepresented and the outsiders, and send us some of what you saw at SUBAC? Like, tell me a little bit about that. Who was going through these? Who are the nonprofits? Where are they coming from in life?
So actually, I've got few of them coming and visiting me actually this coming weekend. So,
oh, nice.
A really, really amazing organization called Aim High Earth. I've got the three founders coming in, staying with me over the weekend, and they focus on basically educating people. So they use kind of nudge sort of and behavioral sort of theory to try and change people's behavior around their climate sort of actions. We had other organizations, people like Instrat, who were looking at the decarbonization of the coal industry in Poland. We had other organizations who were looking at deforestation in the Congo, right? We have one of the biggest carbon sinks there, and whether people could be using data, satellite data, for example, to look at illegal clearing of jungle areas and illegal roads.
Sure.
So all of these people, and I think this is kind of the common thread, is just removing barriers for people who want to go and do better things, where people have been either, you know, coming from non-traditional backgrounds, who have been locked out of access for some reason, to just say, look, if you are bright and you want to do this, if you want to work in tech, if you want to solve these problems, if you want to go and change the world, you know, and you know, create a better life for yourself as well as for others, then, you know, don't be bound by the cards that you have been dealt. Let's see if we can open you some doors. And I think that's really, I guess, going back to that fairness point, you know, that's the bit which kind of just drives me nuts, which is when I see people who are just wanting to move forward and hitting these barriers where it's unfair. You know, they should be able to go and do these things. They should be able to join these industries. They should be able to solve these problems. They are smart. They're capable. They're adding to this world, and we need more of them. And yeah, you know, we shouldn't leave them behind because of just the traditions of how we set up our businesses and traditionally kind of operated.
So what have you learned about helping folks that are coming up against these barriers? You know, it's not just kind of realize their passion, it's actually drive actionable innovation and impact. Like what have you learned works well and doesn't?
I mean, I think, I guess two things. One, which is if you genuinely want to change things, if you want to change the world around you, it is not enough to just do it lip service. And I know that sounds really obvious, but there are so many people who are just, you know, doing things which sound really great. And then it's almost like tourism. And I think, you know, whether we're talking about tourism within DEI, tourism.
Virtue signaling.
Exactly. And driving change and innovating is hard, right? It's painful. It involves having really hard conversations with, you know, the people you're building things with, as well as with yourself, to really sort of say, look, is this doing what we need it to do? And it really is almost like, you know, just constantly beating yourself over the head with a stick until you get it right, you know, and it's brutal. It's not something that is easy to do. It can be a really emotional journey, I think, when you're connecting with something in that way. And I'm sure you've seen this with, you know, the founders that you've supported as well, when they really kind of want something and, you know, you have to think about the pragmatic solution to it. And I think this is that kind of thing, which is when we talk about pragmatism, especially when we're talking about mission-led companies, you have to think about the environment in which whatever you're putting out there is operating. This is not just about you. It may be a moral, wonderful, absolutely the right idea. Yeah. If you cannot get it to land, it won't work. So you've got to kind of take this idea of just being completely mission focused, but just very, very pragmatic as well, because ultimately you've got to understand people's behaviors, you know, how they are irrational and emotional. And, you know, all of us are sort of, you know, self-motivated and have our own needs and all of these types of things, but we're human, right? So the human condition, I think, is really critical to understand as far as innovation and, you know, really figuring out how things can change.
Well, gosh, oh man, this is like soapbox stuff for me. We're about to launch into a tirade. I'm going to try and avoid it, but it's so important because I think this goes for a startup founder. It goes for, you know, kind of a starry-eyed new grad wanting to do something in a nonprofit. Yeah. It goes for somebody within a large corporation trying to change something. Change requires humans to change behaviors, not in the abstract.
Yeah.
Right? Not in the like, oh, people need to do something. It requires John and Jane to do something different. You need to know what, in this case, John and Jane, whoever, want to change. And I feel like particularly with mission-driven companies. This is a universal problem, but particularly with mission-driven companies, I often get into a conversation like, you know, there's too much carbon in the atmosphere. That's a problem. Like, true. Tell me who has that problem, right? And if you can't tell me who is willing to change behavior because of something you're going to do about that problem, like you've got an issue, right?
And this is always that balance, right? Between, you know, keep your heart, keep your passion, and also remember that with all the best intentions in the world, as human beings, we are all self-serving in one way or the other, right? So if you can't think about, you know, to that point of, you know, who is this a problem for? You know, where is the incentive for someone to do something different? You can do a certain amount with people who have goodwill, right? But even when I sort of, you know, think back to Code First Girls days, I used to think about this idea of mutual gain, right? I have what I want to do as an organization, right? I want to teach young women how to code. My clients, that might be a nice to have for them, but that's not really what they care about, right? And I think you can hear it in a lot of different ways. You know, the jobs to be done kind of framework is a really helpful start for anyone who hasn't, you know, approached it in that way. But, you know, what my clients cared about might have been, you know, what's going into their business report? You know, are they going to get a promotion that year? You know, how do they do this when they've got a really small team? So understanding kind of people's motivations and where do they cross over with your motivations? Where can you put something forward which both meets your needs, your mission, but also allows them to do something which they weren't able to do before as well? And I think that's always the kind of the journey kind of going through that.
I mean, I don't think this can be overstated or stated too often. It's amazing how many people, whether they're corporate innovators, sometimes, you know, wielding a budget of $7 and a pack of peanuts and sometimes millions of dollars, or whether they're founders. It's amazing how often we sort of dig in and we realize, actually, we don't really know.
Yeah.
Like the motivations of the people whose behavior we are trying to get to change. And that one little question can unlock, it can be the difference between, you know, actually achieving your mission or not.
Yeah. And I think that this is the thing. I think, and again, I don't want to misattribute every quote to sort of Oscar Wilde, but I think this might have actually been Oscar Wilde. There was a quote which was, it's not selfish to do what you want to do. It's selfish to make someone else do what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this is the thing about, you've got to understand, what do you want? What do they want? And how do you create a product that delivers to both of your needs? And it may be in very different ways, right? You know, you might do something which for you allows you to, you know, sink more carbon. That's your goal. For the others, it might be a way to stop politicians bothering them, right? It might be a way for them to stop being beaten on by legislators, right? So, you know, both can have that same output, but the reasons for that product existing and being used can be quite different. And I think that's always the sort of the creative challenge, I think, with a lot of sort of innovative products.
Completely agree. So as you think about the people, the founders, the executives, the leaders that you worked with through the context of SUBAC in particular, although feel free to go elsewhere as well, what are some of the common traits of these individuals? Is it an agitation for change? Is it a deep lack of satisfaction with the world? Did they want to make $1 billion? What are some of the common traits that have led to people succeeding in driving change against such a seemingly intractable problem as climate?
I think, and thinking about sort of mission-led companies and certainly the sort of SUBAC founders, definitely just that passion for this has to change. Right? This is not enough. And, you know, you can't go to sleep, you can't live your life if you haven't had at least a go at trying to change this, at trying to have a better world in the future, right? I don't think that necessarily means that people are delusional about success. I think if anything, they're quite sort of honest. I think, you know, knowing that startups are startups, right? Doing a lot of these things are challenging. You don't always succeed with things. But just the will to try, I think, is the biggest thing, right? And to give it a go.
Well, to quote about 7,000 other people who I can't name, like, you're not going to succeed if you don't try.
No, right? No. To paraphrase the UK lottery, you need to be in it to win it, right? There you go.
Oh, okay. Yes. I think we just told everybody to go buy more lottery tickets. We'll walk that one back later.
But
you're exactly right. And sorry, I know I interrupted you, but there's something else that has been a thread that you said a couple times, like, because you talk about, you know, that bias to action, right? You're not going to succeed if you don't try. Like, you feel you have to do it. And I think that does actually separate innovators from people who are, I guess, if we're not being charitable, we might be saying innovation theater, or, you know, just kind of standing up shouting. Or if we're being charitable, we could say supporters, right? Like the people who show up and rally around an idea and a cause, they are supporting, even if they're not changing. But that separation is important. Like, is this something you want to personally take on and make a chunk of your life's work, versus is this just something that you believe in?
Yeah. And it's people who get itchy, right?
Yeah.
These are people who are restless, right? You have a restlessness which you just have to keep chipping away at. And, you know, that's not all the time, you know, goodness knows, you know, we don't all wake up in the mornings feeling 100% motivated every single day. At least I don't, certainly. But I think that, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, if you think about, you know, we're all going through life with a series of choices, right? And if at every single gate of those choices, you're just saying, I want things to be better. I want things to be better. I want things to be more sustainable. I want things to be fairer. You know, that's the thing which I think kind of drives people forward, which is just, even if it's not necessarily one specific idea, and you might, you know, think about different innovations and all of this, there's just that pattern to your life around saying, this is the decision tree that I want to take. You know, I need to see this through in this route. And, you know, to just do that, to do it without even thinking every single day, you know, you toss the coin and it's heads every time, you know, or you make it heads every time. So, yeah.
That's awesome. So, okay, I'm going to come back to a question I pegged earlier, and I promise, because you just said make the world fairer again. Is there a tension? Fairness, by the way, I'm all about it. I think it is so bloody important. Every like psychographic profile I've ever taken has said that it's pretty foundational to my personality. So I ask this from a place of deep angst, frankly. Is fairness at odds with innovation? Is there a tension between the concepts in your mind?
In a short answer, I don't think there is with innovation. I do think that fairness can often be at odds with making money, because with some things, when you are trying to create a fairer outcome, it means that you are opening opportunities to people who have been left out. And just numbers, you know, this is just a numbers game, right? For those who are in positions of privilege, who are benefiting from the unfairness, it's going to feel like they are being oppressed, right? Or they are being, you know, their privilege is being taken away. And I think this is where people talk about the sort of normalization of privilege. And I say this as someone who has a lot of privileges in life, right? Even, you know, and you know, there are definitely ways that, you know, I have been disadvantaged as well, but, you know, I have, you know, a lot of privileges. But for me, those privileges are normal. Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think about those things really as being privileges, because it's just, that's my day to day. Right. And if I'm faced with a scenario where suddenly those privileges aren't privileges anymore, right, because the scene has changed and there are more competitors in the space, or, you know, I'm actually not allowed to make as much money as I did before because someone else is going to get a bit of that money. You know, if you are that way inclined, that can feel very unfair, right? I'm taking away from you. It doesn't always have to be a zero-sum game, certainly, but there will be times when, you know, if you think about, I don't know, even just, you know, thinking about going for jobs and stuff like that, you know, if you've got a bigger pool of people, maybe you're not going to be the best candidate. Plain and simple.
Absolutely.
Maybe there's someone who's better than you, right? And maybe those people who are better than you were previously locked out of being in that conversation because of their color of their skin or where they came from or their gender. So these are the things where it's not, you know, once we start creating a fairer society, you know, not everyone is comfortable with that. And certainly, you know, we, you know, the reality is that even when we think about the West, and, you know, I think in the UK, if you are earning more than, I think it's 45,000 pounds, you are globally in the top 5%
of global earners. At least, yeah.
You know, and this is just normal, right? For us in the UK, you know, we have an average UK salary of, I think, £37,000. So, you know, the majority of the population here are in that bracket. So, yeah, it's a strange relationship, I think, with fairness.
Well, I think it is. And I want to spend a bit of time on this because you're going to therapize me a little bit here. But, you know, I think when we think about the fact that kind of entrepreneurial potential, great ideas, I think absolutely are evenly distributed around the world, right? One of the things that's not distributed, to your point, privilege, access, capital, whatever it is, the things that you need to drive change. So here's the thing that I struggle with. And I'm curious for your thoughts. I think a lot of the best entrepreneurs, the best innovators, as measured by the impact they have on society, we're not going to judge whether or not it's good or bad impact, do very unfair things to get there. They collect the resources that they need to make the change, be it capital, be it, you know, political will, support, whatever. They break rules that maybe 95% of people think you should never break, right? And therefore, you know, they work around the system. I think that's a really interesting tension. And one of the things that I like is that you're sort of separating out a definition of fairness embodied by sort of, you know, everybody has the same level playing field from fairness of like following the rules. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts there. Because I, as I think about the great entrepreneurs, I'm like, oh, the people around them think they were playing fair.
Yeah. I think for me, there is a difference between, I don't think that fairness is about not breaking the rules, right? In that, you know, actually, in a lot of cases, fairness is more about breaking the rules than sticking with the rules, right? I mean, wanting equality got gay people the right to get married. Wanting equality gave women's rights, gave black people the right to own houses and vote. You know, this was all about breaking rules to deliver fairness.
Such an important framing.
So actually, people who are chasing equality are the rebels, right? The difference is that you can break rules for a lot of different reasons, right? But when we talk about those people who break rules for their own, purely their own selfish purposes, and, you know, we're all selfish in different ways, but at the expense of others intentionally so, right? That, I think, is the difference, right? And, you know, when I think about, we have a lot of, you know, people out there, big, you know, people who've made loads of money, they have done that on other people's backs, right? And they have taken money. They have, in some cases, you know, not been truthful. And we have plenty of politicians who've been, you know, caught for various things and, you know, fraud and all of these types of things. And I mean, for me, yeah, I don't see the connection with necessarily breaking rules and fairness. I think you can absolutely, you know, be following the rules and be totally unfair and be breaking the rules and be fair as well. But yeah. It's a purpose of that.
I love it. It's some good therapizing. I don't even think that's a word, but also such a cool lesson in there for, you know, people who want to drive change and feel constrained by the system, the rules, what their boss is going to think, et cetera, right? Like, it's an interesting test, you know, is this about me or is this about a mission? And is that mission leading toward a better world, which obviously is wildly subjective and you can go down dangerous paths, but I think it's actually a really interesting test for potential entrepreneurs looking to break out of the system.
Yeah. And, you know, I know we sort of had a very brief chat, you know, and you mentioned I was sort of doing sort of more board roles and stuff. And, you know, there's always that point around, you know, what is the purpose of a company, right? You know, should it be, and there are within, let's say, you know, I think the US, you have, you know, legal constructs which say, you know, the purpose of, you know, a public company is to deliver value for its shareholders, right? That is the purpose, right? That may not be delivering fairness for the world, right? That may not be, that may be, you know, taking advantage of, you know, local resources. It may be removing assets, removing wealth from local populations, all of these types of things. So, you know, there is an example of success, which is done at the expense of others, right? And purely for the gains of a small proportion of the population. And I think this is the thing for me about fairness, which is just that I just don't think I'm that important, right? I really don't, genuinely don't think, you know, that anyone else has more or less of a right to the world and its resources and wonders than I do. I'm not saying that we, you know, go down this sort of communist utopian idea and sort of think everyone's going to have, you know, the same income. Of course not. But, you know, when we comes to big things, when we think about sort of income inequality, it is increasing. You know, we have seen vast divergences in the amount of money held by, you know, the top 10% of the world over the last sort of 50 years. And it is getting further and further. If you just look at even things like, you know, chief exec pay levels and stuff, you know, what was maybe 10 times the average salary is now, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times. So we have to acknowledge that we are just generally working towards creating a more unfair world. And surely, you know, I think there are, you know, hopefully lots of people out there who just want to dig their heels in and go, no, I don't think that's right. I don't think that's the world I want to live in. And I'd like to try and do something about that.
Well, I hope so as well. And I mean, I think we have to acknowledge the role that innovation and technologically driven innovation has played in that, because it has, right? Every time there's a kind of a step change in capabilities in productivity, history shows us it aggregates at the top. And history also shows us, I think, that it rarely ends well when that happens.
Yeah. The thing that people forget about innovation is that, you know, having, you know, more resilient rice varieties is innovation, right? The COVID vaccine is innovation, right?
Absolutely.
So these are things which, again, can deliver, talking to that point about mutual gains, huge benefits to certain groups whilst doing good in the world, right? And allowing a fairer world out there. So, you know, it doesn't have to be either or, I think.
Amazing. Well, so we spent a whole bunch of time kind of zigging and zagging around some of the stuff you've been doing in the past. You've mentioned you're doing a bunch of work now. You're doing work in board advisory. You're doing work in consulting. Tell us just a little bit about what Amali's up to now and next.
Yes. So having spent the last sort of decade or two sort of building companies, doing that 0 to 1 build, I was wanting to take a little break, take advantage of, I guess, the fruits of my labor. And I'd obviously, you know, with running accelerator programs, doing a lot of advisory, I'd always been doing a lot more work. And I recently moved out of London, so I am no longer in the big smoke. And just wanted to make sure that, you know, I didn't forget to smell the roses, right? We are blessed to be these collections of space dust who somehow have, you know, consciousness in the world for a certain number of years, you know, to just be working to or living to work. I think, you know, I don't think that's a good use of sort of anyone's life. So was really looking to sort of, you know, continue to learn, continue to support organizations. I'd been doing some board roles for a number of years and decided I wanted to have a go at switching to a portfolio career. So that is basically sitting half my time working with boards and, again, doing a lot of work with both organizations, large organizations as well as small. So I'm chair at a company called Digital Camp, which is focused on teaching kids how to build tech products which have a focus on sustainability and become better future leaders. I'm on the board of Aberdeen Standard Life's Foundation. I'm also on the board at Ada College, which is a specialist digital college. And I also do sort of advisory work on the side as well. So thinking of my recent activities, actually, I was running some sessions at the Cambridge Institute for Sustainability Leadership. So they have a sustainability accelerator where I was, again, running sessions for their cohorts on product market fit and thinking about client customer experience. But again, sort of just really doing, I guess, what I had been doing for many years, which was helping people to solve problems and think about how to be successful, you know, considering the world around them. And just really enjoying actually having that opportunity to, you know, take stock, be able to do that advisory, but also to be able to take a holiday and not be, you know, at the end of a phone, because, you know, as a founder, it's you never really have a rest. You know, it's a bit of an endless sort of a bicycle ride there, which I loved. And who knows, you know, never say never as far as, you know, restlessness is a thing we talked about. But for the moment, I'm enjoying actually the board work and the advisory work.
Amazing. Well, for folks who want to keep in touch with you, who want to follow your work going forward, what's the best way? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you blogging? Are you hanging out on a particular beach?
beaches, always beaches. So actually, if anyone is in the southeast coast of the UK, come and hang out in Rye. It's a lovely place to live. We have an amazing beach here. But no, LinkedIn is definitely the best way to go. And that's linkedin.com/in/Amali. So it's nice and easy to find that one. I have been thinking about doing some blogs and stuff as well, but I will get to that point. But what I have been doing more recently, actually, is just creating some little mini communities around, again, supporting people who are wanting to develop non-exec director roles, so board roles and stuff, helping them to think about how they can kind of access that. And again, coming from, you know, backgrounds where they may not traditionally have sort of, you know, done that before or be typically, you know, something that they have sort of a lot of insight into. So I'm organizing a few sort of conversations with people operating in the space to help people understand more about what that is and doing bits there as well. So yeah, watch this space. There will be more to come on that.
I love it. Well, thank you for joining me for this conversation today, Amali. And this was just so much fun. I'm looking back, we covered a lot of topics all somehow.
We did, and
really interesting stuff. We are at time. If you had just kind of one parting bit of wisdom or one little bit of advice that you would be providing to people early in their career who are saying, you know what, I want to make change in the world, what would that piece of advice be?
I think something which always struck me when I look back on my career was, especially early in my career, I spent far too much time screening myself out of doing things because I thought that I was too early or too late. I'm too young to do this, or I should have done this when I was 12 or whatever, right? And the reality is it's never too early and it's never too late. Just get started, you know, and it doesn't have to be anything big. Start with something with just one other person where you both go and do something, you know, in whatever space it is that you're looking to, you know, baby steps, thinking about that, you know, what you can achieve in 10 years. That's a lot of days. And I think if you really want to be brutal with yourself, actually, there's a great blog, which is called Wait But Why. And this guy basically he goes digging. He's exactly my dream character, right? Because he goes digging into why things happen, really random things. But he also did this calendar, which is terrifying in itself, which has every single, if you're living for 70 years, it has a calendar with a week, a little square for every week of a 70-year life.
Ooh,
where you can go and just look at that and just see, it's like, you know, we only have so much time, right? And yeah, little things, start today.
I love it. Just get started and don't get too terrified and existential at this calendar. I think you might be referring to The Life of a Typical American, which I just looked up. And
yes,
as an American, even one who is now living abroad, this hits close to home. So anyway,
yes.
Okay. Well, Amali, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate you kind of starting your week off with the podcast here. And it's so good to catch up.
Likewise, Ian. Absolute pleasure. And thank you very much for inviting me to take part.
Cheers.
So that's a wrap for today's episode of Alchemist X Innovators Inside. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you found value and insight in today's discussion, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone who is passionate about corporate innovation or just curious about great ideas and practical insights. Until next time, I'm Ian Bergman. Thanks for tuning in.